So we're here with part two. Matt and I just took a little bit of a break, and I've talked to him extensively about the history of water, and he has a little project connecting the drops, and basically just takes a look at the history of water and how obviously it is so important to all of life, and just how over time it's getting worse and worse, and how we need to get better with kind of looking after a pillar of life. So Matt, like, let's get stuck into the history of water.
Yeah, thanks, Ollie. So I had an opportunity to, I guess, think about water a bit more and try and understand how did we get where we are. That was kind of the driving force at the beginning. Was I got some questions I haven't got answers for, and I really want to know, like, why does my river at home look brown? How did that come about? So I kind of decided to take a real historical, archival look at where did this start, and why is my water looking like it is? So I took a view of, let's take a look at land use and what's happened through time. So when I started scratching around, I started looking for documents that could tell me and inform me about Indigenous history of my local area. And
Is Ballina?
Which is Ballina up in northern New South Wales. So this is the Richmond River that I live on, and it's quite a big river. It's probably, I think, it's Australia's eighth largest river. It's got a very big floodplain, 1,000 square kilometre floodplain. So quite a big catchment and a big river, and historically incredibly productive river. So it was an absolutely abounding commercial fishery in its day, but now it's a whimper. It's sad to say the largest commercial catch out of the river now is European carp. So that's in a bad way. But look, before we get to the now, we will need to go right back, and I want to understand, how did the landscape look before colonial forces turned up on the landscape? And so I tried to find what I could that was written. Now, of course, there's actually nothing written that's preserved from pre-colonial time. I found a whole bunch of documents that were written by early colonial settlers about Indigenous people.
Because a lot of Indigenous history is just word of mouth.
It's word of mouth. It was oral history.
Yeah.
The stories were passed on, but they were told as stories. It was an oral narrative. There was storytelling was central with ceremony to maintain the knowledge base. And these things are tactile, they're visual, they're audible, but they're not chipped into stone. And so I initially was able to read these kind of, largely British accounts of what they were seeing, of how the Indigenous people were initially behaving around these early settlements. But I thought, well, look, I've really got to go at some point here and ground truth this sort of information, as interesting as it was, and it gave me some clues about how they were interacting in that landscape. But I ended up going and meeting Uncle Doug and part of his mob out near Kyogle in the upper catchment of the Richmond, and they were incredibly generous with their time to meet with me. And I had these questions that came from oysters, really, was a starting point for me. So I live down right on the lower river on the estuarine areas, and the river, in fact, the town Ballina, it's believed the name might have come from Bulina, which was an Indigenous word for the area, which loosely interpreted as place of many oysters.
Wow.
And as you walk along my street, if you look at the curb and guttering, in the curb and guttering are oyster shells. So why are there oyster shells up here on the hill, up from the river? Well, they'd used the Aboriginal middens, the shell piles that had been created through Indigenous ceremony and consumption of oysters over thousands of years. They created these structures called middens, which were hundreds of metres long, 5 metres high, maybe 20, 30 metres across. And some archaeological digs back in the 70s started doing carbon dating on them to say, well, how old are these oysters? How long have Indigenous people been eating oysters? So there were 1,750 years of oysters in those piles. And they looked at that the oysters were actually layered and you could see the youngest were on the top and the oldest were on the bottom, and there was continuous consumption, annual consumption. And interestingly, in those early colonial records, there was a record of an observation of some 500 people sitting down on the middens in North Creek on the Richmond, eating oysters and participating in some ceremonies that at the time the colonialists didn't understand what was going on. But they were there for a couple of weeks and then they left. It was like, that's interesting, they left. And it really stuck with me. I'm like, well, hang on. So they ate 17 tonnes of oysters a year, they worked out from these piles. They ate 17 tonnes of oysters a year, almost every year. Then they stopped and they left. Now, like, why'd they leave? Why would you leave if, A, oysters are delicious, B, you got heaps of them there. There's plenty more still to harvest. You could have harvested more. We know they could have harvested more because when we turned up, when colonialists turned up, we did harvest more. In fact, we didn't stop. We went flat out and we took out all the oysters in the estuary within about 30 years. We literally scraped all of the oysters out of the Richmond River in 30 or so years to the point where there was not enough left. We had to start farming them. And we set up an oyster farming industry in the late 1800s in the Richmond River. So this was like, well, 30 years of colonial management and we eradicated all the oysters, 1,750 years of indigenous management, and it was perfect.
Fully sustainable.
Yeah. Like, how'd you do it? How did you manage that? And I said that to Doug. I said, I'm just interested to understand.
How old's Doug?
He was an older guy. He's an elder of the local group, and he just said to me, look, we knew. And he just left that with me. He said, we knew it was time to go because we knew by looking at some of the other signals in the environment that another food resource was available for us in another area, that we could go to that area. And we also knew that if we didn't go, we wouldn't necessarily be able to come back and harvest again next year.
Wow.
So there was this years of accumulated knowledge about living within your means and looking after the environment to support what you were doing. And I sort of said, is there more to it than that? You know, because I said, it seems like there's a difference there. So when the colonialists turned up, there was a motive for them to get more. You know, they had a motive, which was they could sell them. So there was an ability to make money out of oysters. So I said, did you guys trade oysters? Was there a, you know, how did you get a leg up to be an elder or, you know, some sort of a leader in your community as an Indigenous person? What would give you that leg up? And, you know, would being the best harvester do that? If you harvested more, the guy who got the most out, would that make you elevate in your group? And he said, well, no, that would make you go down. If you were harvesting for yourself, you would go down in status. If you were taking more than you were sharing to others, you would go down. And it was a total kind of recognition I had to come to, that there's a real value piece here, that the value systems they operated on were that you shared. To go up in society and be valued in your community,
share more.
You shared what you had. The guy who shared the most was the guy the most respected. That was how you gained status. And if you did the personal accumulation thing, it's all for me, you went backwards. In fact, you might even well get booted out and not be part of the community and have to fend for yourself, which at the time would have been incredibly difficult. So this was a real different value proposition that I then sort of started to realise, well, this is something that probably is catalysing the changes that begin to happen in the landscape. It's kind of like the values are the excuse to go and do what you do and say, well, this is our values, this is what we do. And I ended up digging into this case study further and watching what happened to the landscape, and we saw that the cedar cutters came into the catchment first in Ballina. So They came in to get the big trees and harvest the highest value timber. And these were, by all reports, fairly rough men. These were men who, well, it's more than like to drink. These were men that were nearly more drink than man. These were men that, you know, in terms of spending time lying out the front of the pub, that was natural. And there are some really saucy stories about their other behaviours that perhaps aren't best retold. But they were making a name for themselves in the wrong way. And the British colony were looking on. And there was some, I think, acceptance at the time that this was not the sort of colony we wanted to be forming in Australia. As the British thought more highly of themselves than to be rolling about out the front of the pub. And so the governor at the time, Governor Robinson, he brought in the Crown Land Act. And this was an act that came in 1860. It was one of the great acts in Australia, really, to give opportunity to people. It was quite a socially flattening thing, because he let everybody have a crack at pegging out land and offered it fairly cheaply for people who wanted to have a go at becoming farmers. But his motivation was one where he said, you know what we need? We need Australia to become a civilised, suggesting that cedar cutters may not be civilised, and also inferring, sadly, that Indigenous people weren't civilised, which was just deep naivety and convenience, so that the country could be taken from them. And then realised that, well, we'll become civilised agrarian society. That's what we're going to aim for here. So the agrarian was to be agricultural, and so farming was then gentrified as a thing. It was better. It was way better than being a bloke who rolled around the front of the pub who just cut down a tree. So as the land was offered out, this was the vision. This was the cultural vision that was presented about farming, and it has in fact really set up for Australia our view of farming as an enterprise that's the activity of the civilised agrarian farmers, that we will forever have this high level of standing tied to that. Now, what was interesting was that when he said you can go and farm it and the Crown will grant you that land, but you've got to clear it of native vegetation. Now, that was, it was a mistake. Let's call it as it was. What it did was it meant that native vegetation had a negative value. So the focus moving into this new economy was that we need to develop an economy. To develop an economy, we need to exploit the natural resources. That's why we harvest all the oysters out. That's why we cut down all the trees. That's why we try and farm the land. So
basically saying the land is more valuable than what's in on the land.
Correct. And it really didn't acknowledge what the land did or how it functioned.
For
the whole ecosystem. It just missed the piece. And the piece that connects the landscape is the water. So the piece that they missed was that when they started clearing the landscape, so they did things that were convenient for business initially. So the first business was timber getting and timber milling, and they had to get the logs down the river. And if there were snags in the river, they blocked the passage of the logs they tried to float down to the mill. So they pulled the snags out. So they went systematically along the whole river, pulled out every single snag and burnt it on the bank. To get the logs to the river, they had to clear the riverbank. So they got rid of all the native vegetation on the riverbank that was holding the bank together. That destabilized the banks. And all this sediment started pouring into the river because of this destabilized, now cleared landscape, meant that the sediment was now flowing off. So this soil that had taken years to build and create fertility was now being shot off out into the sea. That had meant that the oysters in the river were being smothered, and that it actually created a new oyster disease. So the mud that flowed down the river created a microenvironment on the shells for mudworm, an aptly named worm if ever there were one. Australians particularly creative with naming. So the mud settles on the shell, the mudworm gets a bit jiggy on the shell, some babies then punch into the shell and kill the oyster. So the oysters started dying in the river from mudworm in the late 1890s. It's like, why did that happen? Well, it happened because we changed the water. We added dirt to it, and it weren't meant to be there. And that's harmed the aquatic productivity, and kind of circling back to my obsession with fishing, that was probably some of the first hits to the fishery that were taking place. But then things stepped along with time, and we saw farming change more. We saw wetlands going, oh, well, those areas could be better in dry periods. We could use those. Let's drain them, because swamps were viewed as dirty places. They had all sorts of myths around them. We had bunyips. We had stories created to make swamps evil places that must be drained. Now, it turns out that those wetlands are critical fish habitats. It's where the food for most of the babies comes from. For baby fish, wetlands are the thing. They are the supermarket of food for baby fish. But we drained them and then turned them into different types of vegetation for cattle grazing or for sugarcane on my catchment, and different types of cropping. Unfortunately, that meant that we no longer got the water penetration. So the water thing, again, wetlands, super important. The rain used to fall, fill up the wetland, and just sit in there and process the organic matter. Water would penetrate into the groundwater, recharge the aquifers of the area. Wetlands are points of recharge of groundwater. Now, people probably, it's not front of mind about when a river is running and it's not raining, where does that water come from? If it's not falling out of the sky, how is the water running down the river? Well, the water running is the groundwater running back in to the river.
Wow.
Right? So that's the groundwater recharge that you need to keep the river flowing. Now, in the fishery kind of nerd science world, we know that fishery productivity, in terms of how many fish do we get out of a catchment, is highly correlated to what we call the persistence of stream flow. So after rain, how long does it keep flowing for? That persistence is highly correlated to how healthy that river will be for fish productivity. If you clear the landscape, the water runs off real fast. You get a big scouring flood peak, it goes down real fast, and then it doesn't persist. So we lose that persistence of stream flow simply because we changed the way the landscape worked with water. We now see things like massive floods. So most people will have heard about North Coast's terrible floods in Lismore that have led to, you know, some 4,000 homes being severely damaged or lost. That flood peak, in part, is a consequence of 1860s land clearing that meant that that rainfall now races off the slope, because if you've got some trees there, you don't even need all of them there. If we just had bands of trees, we could slow that water down and we could get more of that water into the ground. And pushing it into the ground is a fantastic place to store water because it doesn't evaporate. We've created structures on our landscape called dams, and we call them water storages, which is one of the great misnomers of our infrastructure. So storage suggests you put it in there, it's like a bank, it'll be in there and you get it back out. But what they are is evaporation basins. So what goes in, you get less out because they've got a big surface area and the water is evaporating out of those dams. And so you're actually losing water from the river and from the system by putting in a dam. Wow. So the best place to store water is underground, so as to maximize our groundwater recharge and then maximize our stream flow persistence. And it's fascinating outside of Australia. So I've just been at the World Recreational Fishing Conference, and there was a guy speaking there from the States who was telling us about the US pulling out dams, removing redundant water storages to restore natural flow so that fish can swim up and down rivers. you know, there's these old dad jokes that are, you know, a fish swims up a river, runs into a wall, and he says, "Ah, damn." It's fundamental to fish movement, and they've realised that in the States. Now they're investing in removing dams. And in Australia, we're talking about putting more dams in. And you realise, damn, that ain't a good idea. We should be thinking more carefully about how we use water, and particularly about what types of farming pursuits and the way we farm are smarter uses of water. So we know now, you know, we know for a good long while that land clearing is an accelerator of climate change. So if we expand our land clearing, which we are continuing to do in Australia at very fast rates, certainly in New South Wales, Queensland, and now Northern Territory, these are accelerants for climate change because we get greater emissions out of that country and less drawdown. But we're actually doing land clearing with chemicals all the time. So when we spray out a paddock with a pre-emergent herbicide, we take all the vegetation off that landscape. We go back to scorched earth. That is land clearing, but we're doing it two or three times a year for cropping cycles.
Yeah.
As soon as we do that, that soil heats up because it's not shaded by vegetation. The soil temperature goes up, evaporation goes up, we lose water. That precious water, gone. And not going into the soil, not recharging groundwater, not making it to the stream. Problematic. If we leave vegetation on there, so cover cropping is really quite an old technique of managing our landscapes better. It both holds the soil in place, but it also enhances recharge. And so we get more water into the soil, we get longer roots, we get more carbon in the soil, we get more storage in the soil, we get crops that are more resilient with less rain. So there's all these virtuous benefits of actually changing the way that we manage some of our landscapes to think about them from a water perspective. What's efficient to do with water? And particularly when it comes to chemistry, how do we not contaminate that water?
That's what's crazy, is just the lack of thinking about that and kind of seeing it as, let's do the quick option to clear it so we can use it, when there's so much more to it. Like even talking about I don't know if you want to get into it too much, but maybe you could quickly go over the ants and just in regards to how the water got so polluted from that.
Yeah, so look, we have a way of responding to things that's, it's somewhat of a formulaic response, I think, in Australia, where we label things invasive if they're not native, invasive species. So they might be things like an invasive weed that we then go on a campaign of trying to kill the weed with herbicide. We have things like, different types of grasses that are invasive, and it's required on landholders to actually use toxic herbicides to kill the grass. But there's actually other ways that could be done. There was a farmer up in Braidwood in the Southern Highlands there between Canberra and the coast who recognised he had a whole lot of this particular grass that was called a noxious pest, a noxious weed. You must spray it out. You must use toxic chemicals to get rid of it. But he discovered that he could use nutrient to get rid of it, natural nutrient. He used urine. Not just his own, because he did have quite a bit, but he used the output of a music festival.
Wow.
To apply to his grass.
And what lot of piss.
A lot of urine. But what he realised was, by fertilising that area, that then shifted the balance away from being in favour of the noxious weed, and it promoted things that were more aggressive and took it over. So he didn't need to spray chemicals at all. So he found a way of managing using a nature-based solution.
Wow.
It took some more thinking. It took some lateral thinking, but he found a way of doing it without instantly reaching for chemical. But we see it again and again. We've recently seen the honeybee varroa mite. So it's a little pest that gets on honeybees. The bee industry in Australia has been terrified for years that this pest would come into Australia with our trade, come in probably in a shipping container from a country that has it. Australia's the last place without it. So there's a sense of inevitability. It's going to get here. And it did turn up around the port of Newcastle and was identified in a number of beehives. Now, beekeepers are scared of it because it's been tied to causing mortality in beehives overseas and collapse of beehives. Some groups attribute it with what's called colony collapse disorder in bees. But the story's more complicated. Again, if you do a bit more reading, and the bit more reading is published in some big journals like Nature. Now, not that I expect you get Nature, Ollie. You won't get it at the newsagent, and you won't see it on YouTube. But in Nature, there's an article, it's very clear, that if you expose the bee to a tiny bit of a neonicotinoid insecticide, so these are a new class of insecticide, the bee is weak. It's weaker. It's not dead. It's just a bit weaker. And it means that it'll get more mites climbing on it. It won't be able to clean them off. And the bee is more susceptible to dying of mites if it has that exposure. But even that's not the whole story. If the mite gets exposed in the hive to the same chemical, so the bee picked it up when it was out foraging. So it's gone foraging out into a paddock. It's landed on things around agricultural applications. It's picked it up in the pollen and it's brought the chemical back to the hive. It's now exposed the mite in the hive to the chemical. And the mite has now supercharged its fertility. It's making more mites. So the effect of the chemical on the mite was actually to jack up their reproductive rate.
What?
And so the bee then is now challenged with more mites and is weaker. And so the bees begin to collapse. Now, what did we do when the varroa mite arrived? You could have read the Nature paper and said, well, a good idea would be to stop using neonicotinoid insecticides in the environment because they're going to make the bees weak and they're not going to be able to stand up to this new mite. That could have been one option, but we didn't take it. Interestingly, in Europe, they did take that option. They removed that whole chemical class from use in all agriculture in Europe. Several years ago now, there are no outdoor uses approved at all due to its toxicity on pollinators like bees. But Australia, we've taken a very different approach and we allow use, and unsurprisingly, varroa is spreading. The response of government was, let's eradicate the hives. We'll use some more insecticide to kill these hives, which is kind of part of the problem to begin with, but we're using more chemicals into our environment that don't necessarily disappear. Now, the same things happened when we had fire ants come into the country. Again, I don't know if anyone has any luck eradicating fire ants or any ant. It's very hard to get rid of ants. I mean, they are a very persistent little insect, and it's perhaps a whimsical state to think that we could ever eradicate them after that they've got a footprint into the Australian environment. But we've tried, and somehow we wanted to say we tried, even though it looks like we're failing. We still wanted to say we tried, but the trying was $300 million worth of insecticide applied to the landscape. And everyone's like, yeah, but we've got to get rid of the mite. And I'm like, well, is there any collateral damage from $300 million worth of insecticide being applied to a landscape? Could anything else be caught in the crossfire here? So I posed this question to some of my clients back at the Australian Prawn Farmers Conference in about 2013 and said, look, this new class of chemicals, they're turning up in water. It turns out they're water soluble. And you guys farm something in water that you're pulling out of rivers, draining land where this stuff's being applied. So I'm not Nostradamus, but I'm pretty sure that your rivers are pretty soon going to be contaminated with this chemical because we're using it. And everywhere else that it's been used, it does do that. So I said, look, can we perhaps start looking for it and perhaps start asking for better regulation of these products because they appear a huge risk for prawns? Now, nothing happened, but they did eventually fund CSIRO to look for the chemicals in the river. And about 6 weeks, so it was in September 2016, they looked in the Logan River in Queensland, so right at the bottom of Moreton Bay, and they found four chemicals in the water. One of them was the chemical they were using for the fire ant control program, and it was present at a level likely to cause toxicity, sublethal toxicity, stress to crustaceans in that waterway. But they also found another nicotinoid pesticide in there, imidacloprid, and they found two other toxic insecticides in there. Now, our system, our regulatory system, it doesn't really embrace the idea of a mixture because it assesses things one at a time. Now, I wasn't a great math student, but I did understand that 1 plus 1 plus 1 was 3. But in our regulatory system, 1 plus 1 plus 1 is 1 because we only analyse each chemical one at a time. We don't have really any assessment of the mixture consequences. The two chemicals could add up. They could work together. They could synergize. In fact, 1 plus 1 could be 3. Now, it turns out there are nerd scientists out there, bless them, who do some of these studies
like you.
Now. Well, yeah, look, hands up. You can't help who you become. I'm a nerd. Proud, wear the badge. Now, those kind of studies have shown now that sometimes chemicals do synergize. 1 plus 1 can equal 2.1, 2.5 or 3 in terms of impact. So when you get this multiple exposure in a waterway, those crustaceans that are trying to live in that waterway are under some threat. They're under some stress. And what happened in December was those prawns also got exposed to a virus that likely came here from Asia called white spot virus. It's a particularly nasty virus for prawns and particularly nasty if they live in a prawn farm where there's even a bit more stress than in the wild. They're on different diets, they're in a crowded space, the water quality may not be as perfect as the river. In prawn farms, you see massive disease outbreaks with white spot virus, huge mortality. It is the most feared prawn disease on the planet. It's caused billions of dollars of loss in Asia. And in December 2016, it arrived on the Logan River. Australia had been free of it. But in 2016, our freedom ended. And part of why it ended is probably because our prawns were too weak to resist it, because they were weakened before the exposure to the virus. And so this is part of probably why it happened, where it did and when it did, as to these types of immunosuppressive exposures. So these things turn out that they're kind of important even at low levels. And following, you know, connecting those drops, you can see that there is a link between where that water goes. If we look back in time, that water was probably created somewhere around 4 billion years ago. And it has been doing laps of the Earth between the atmosphere, the surface, the groundwater, and the ocean ever since. But in the last 70 years, we've really changed that water. It was the same for a very long time, and when the Industrial Revolution hit, things have changed.
So it really is like just all connected.
It's all connected.
And from kind of like a more solution point of view, is the water, if we are more careful with what we put into it and use like a lot more, less pesticides and everything, will it bounce back?
Well, look, a lot of these systems have a lot of resilience.
Yeah.
Nature is unbelievably resilient, actually. There's some interesting examples of where the pressure that humans place on the environment get taken out. They're often in odd places like the border at Kashmir in disputed territory. Or in fact, back in Cyprus, where some of our family came from, there's a disputed boundary. And there's a whole town that sits in a no-go zone called Famagusta. And that town now has trees growing through the middle of the road. There's branches going out windows of the housing, and it's now a biodiversity hotspot. So the resilience of nature is there.
It's like any apocalypse movie.
Yeah.
I'm Legend.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And I mean, even around Chernobyl became a wildlife sanctuary, and in fact, nature began recolonizing, regenerating, recovering that area without further additional insults. So the message is one of kind of more, we've got to take the pressure off to allow the regeneration to begin. It's certainly not all lost. It's far from all lost. We know that we can grow food with other techniques. We know that we can help farmers transition to different techniques, but we do have to help. We have to make food choices that help drive our profit. Our money is making choices about the food that comes at us. We can direct that money to support the farmers to help them change when we begin to understand, well, actually, the benefit's real direct.
Even spending that $300 million on the pesticides, that can go elsewhere.
We could put that elsewhere perhaps more wisely, yeah. And we could look at what other potentials for nature-based control might be prudent. You know, it's not to say that I want fire ants crawling around my house. No one's saying that's a good idea. But we've got to be real careful about a choice to deploy that scale of toxin into the environment and hope it's going to be all good. Because we've got a lot of signals from the environment saying it ain't all good. I just was talking to a colleague last night about, he does surveys of fish in the Murray Darling. And he said the Darling is nearly dead. He said there are so few fish in the Darling River. He said, I've never seen anything like it. It's completely knackered. And I'm like, how can that be? We've spent so much money on trying to buy back environmental water. What are we missing here about the way we're managing our landscapes? It's clearly not going well for the fish in those landscapes. But then when we look wider, is it really going well for us? And you have to arrive at the point, well, actually, no. When I hear there's a doctor shortage, what I hear is there's a health crisis, an illness crisis, ill health. When I hear there's a fertility problem, I don't hear that it's just women choosing to have children later, because I know that young people are having trouble having children. And I hear there's a problem with fertility. When my dad sends me a newspaper article about Ingham's roosters that are causing a hit to the profit of the business because they don't want to mate with hens because they're just not feeling it. It's a sign about the change to fertility. I know in pig herds producing pigs, fertility's declining. In dairy herds, fertility's declining. Human fertility's declining. Fish fertility's declining. We see it across. So it's like, well, we've got to take some actions here. And we've got to be prudent, careful about those choices. But we do have options in hand to go.
Because, yeah, we're just as part of the environment as they are.
We are in it. We are within it. We're not above it. And we are 100% not outside of it. We are not yet in Elon Musk Mars territory. Right? And I don't want to go there for me. I've no interest in living on Mars. I've no interest in living a virtual life completely disconnected from all the natural processes and natural ecology. That is to me to become not human. So my interest is in trying to return the health of nature, the health of ecology back into a functional state where we can live in some balance with nature, where we all get a go.
Yep.
It's not just kind of a pyramid and sitting atop the pyramid holding up a sword is a man. God, it's all mine. We've got to shake that out and reformat thinking about ecology, that we're all in there, men, women, whatever your gender preference, it matters not at this point. But all the animals are in there with us, all the plants, all the insects, the whole shooting match. We are connected to the whole lot, and their fate is our fate. When we start seeing insect declines, and I hear China population declining, even though they're paying people to try and have more children. When I see those declines, I'm like, what's happening, people? Time to make some changes here, I think.
Connect the drops.
Connect those drops. That's what we've got to do. And follow the water.
Wow.
Because it tells us the story that we need to know. If we make that water clean again, we are like well on the way to letting nature restore and recover if we keep that water clean.
Empowering nature.
It does its own thing. It's a powerhouse.
Yeah.
You know, so it's about us kind of getting out of the way in a sense, just not continuing to pour things onto it and into it that it has no way of coping with, that are toxic to it. So we've got a job in front of us. We've got a heap of choices.
Yeah.
But I honestly think we can kind of make it through that wormhole. And it is an educative way to get there, to talk about it, begin those discussions, you know, talk to our friends about it, break down the taboos.
Get on the landing podcast.
Get on the podcast. Tap in, hook in, plug in.
Well, that's a perfect segue. We'll take another break and then we'll come back with a kind of solution segment to kind of wrap things up.
Terrific.